Sarcoma Stories is a podcast created by Sarcoma Foundation of America to highlight the voices and experiences of patients, survivors, and care partners. After listening, be sure to join our Sarcoma Stories podcast Facebook group to connect with the community and discuss the episode. Follow us and enable notifications on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform so you don't miss new episodes. You can also find all episodes and information on this subtype or your subtype on SFA's website, curesarcoma.org. Links are in this episode's description. Hi, listeners. We're back from our summer hiatus with a very special episode to kick off season two. August 2025 marked the beginning of SFA's 25th anniversary year, and we couldn't think of a better way to celebrate than by going back to where it all began, with a conversation featuring SFA's three founders, Dr. Mark Thornton, Tricia Thornton, and Dr. Jack Brooks. In this episode, you'll hear the story behind SFA's founding, from the spark of an idea to the early humbling days, through the years of growth and impact. Mark, Tricia, and Jack reflect on the journey so far, what they're most proud of, and their hopes for the future of the sarcoma community and the organization over the next 25 years. Listen in and then join the conversation. If you have questions for Mark, Tricia, or Jack, head over to the Sarcoma Stories Facebook group and ask away. We'd love to hear from you. Welcome to Sarcoma Stories. And for our returning listeners, welcome back. If you're new here, we're so happy you've joined us. I'm Tasha. I'm one of your hosts.
And I'm Brandy. I'm your other host.
And we have a very special episode for you today in honor of Sarcoma Foundation of America's 25th anniversary. To mark this incredible milestone, we're honored to be joined by our three founders, Dr. Mark Thornton, Tricia Thornton, and Dr. Jack Brooks. We're so excited to dive into this conversation, learn more about the roots of SFA, hear their reflections on the journey over the past 25 years. So Mark, Tricia, and Jack, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us and being here today.
Thank you.
Mark and Tricia, would you like to tell us a bit about how your sarcoma journey started?
Sure. Our son, Jeffrey, when he was 3 years old, we noticed that he had developed a little lump on his tongue. So the doctor actually thought it was an infection and prescribed an antibiotic, but thought we should schedule surgery just to be safe. After the surgery, we were told that the tumor was benign. I can't think of the name of it right now, but it was some benign tumor. But about a week later, we got a call from the surgeon telling us that it was, in fact, an alveolar soft part sarcoma, a malignant tumor. As you can imagine, we wanted to find any information we possibly could about it. There wasn't a lot at the time. This would have been around 1998. And what was available was not good. The prognosis was just not very good. In fact, the tumor, what I was reading, was always described as often indolent, always fatal. Anyway, one day I happened to run across an article. It was a scientific article of a case study that had a patient in it. One of the patients was a two-year-old boy that had a much bigger tumor than Jeff had, and it showed that he was 32 years out. So I wanted to know what happened to him. I was able to track down the number of the co-author on that paper, which was Dr. John Brooks. And I was able to call him, and he actually took my call, which I was very happy about. We talked a long time, and we stayed in touch, and we'd email. I'd often ask him questions or run things past him. In fact, Jack actually offered to look at Jeffrey's slide, the tumor, because the initial diagnosis was so unclear. We talked quite a bit over the weeks and months, but there was a CTOS meeting that year, this Connective Tissue Oncology Society meeting that was near us. So we decided to go. So we went to the meeting and there was a bunch of tables set up. And when we got there, there was only a couple of seats left near one of the rooms. So we went and sat down and we're just taking in the meeting. And then after a while, the man sitting next to me got up and asked a question to the panel. And his voice sounded so familiar. So I whispered to Mark and I said, I think that's Dr. Brooks. At the break, I approached him and sure enough, it was Dr. Brooks. In my conversations with him over the weeks and months, he had talked about wanting to start a foundation and because he thought sarcoma was a forgotten cancer and he could tell you more about that. But we talked about it some more then and then again over time and we thought, and he was just having trouble. He had already written the bylaws for it. And we thought, why not? We got together and said, maybe we can help and do something. I think the three of us just had the right skill set at the right time to get this foundation started and going. It really was quite remarkable to think about that we were able to do it. There just wasn't a lot of information there. There was just no movement. In fact, Mark and I were shocked at the time that we didn't think about starting a foundation. We thought we would just join with somebody else. And there was just nothing there.
Yeah, at the time in that era, there was a lot of advocacy movements, a lot of activists emerging from the cancer space, building on top of what the AIDS community had done in the 1980s and 90s. The cancer community as a whole was following their model about getting active and making their voices heard. And then within the large cancer community, the types of cancer, the breast cancer groups, multiple myeloma, pancreatic cancer, they were especially trend-setting with regards to approaches to how to get more money for cancer research, and then their specific cancer types, how to engage FDA for regulatory reform, just like the AIDS groups had done successfully previously. And so like Tricia said, we wanted to join that sarcoma group that was out there to just join whatever effort was going on in sarcoma. And like Tricia said, we found out that there absolutely was none, zero organization with Jack's kind of brains behind the whole notion of starting a 501c3 nonprofit charity. And then with our energy and motivation, we all got together and put in the paperwork and then got things started. I remember the first time we got a post office box and got a very small, ancient, archaic website set up, but I remember getting our first $25 donation. And then what a thrill it was to see that somebody actually cared enough to donate. So that was our very first donation. And so it was remarkable. And then that just began the slow kind of organic growth. We had different kind of turbochargers along the way, for sure. Of course, Brandy's probably been our biggest turbocharge of our 25 years, 5 years ago, to catapult to what had been a modestly successful organization into quite the kind of leader, especially of this space, eclipsing what had been a bunch of different smaller organizations in the 2000s and early 2010. But really, USFA emerged as quite the leading group for the voice of sarcoma patients.
Yeah, it's amazing. Honestly, I'm getting emotional just hearing you all talk about how it all came together. We get asked that question a lot. And I'd like to hear from your perspective too, Jack, because why would you already have the bylaws written? You obviously saw a great need.
Throughout the 80s and 90s, I became a sarcoma expert and attended lots of meetings of different oncology groups and so forth. And sarcoma was always, first of all, the last talked about. They had maybe two drugs to work with the oncologists, and it's not their fault. There just wasn't the research. So I was just getting more and more frustrated as the years went on, listening to the same thing over and over. And I wanted to see more research. So along with some upsetness from some online emails that I was answering as a sarcoma patients, I had the idea, hey, let's do something and start something that could contribute money for more research. Aside from the NIH, which was funding sarcoma research at a very low level. So I had gotten some documents together, and it just so happened that that very same year earlier than when I met the Thorntons, Robert Urich was coming to Roswell Park Cancer Institute, and he had a synovial sarcoma. So I'm quickly getting my documents ready, and I made a nice three-ring binder, and I brought it to the fair and met him. And I said, I would like him to be an honorary member if he would, and so forth. And I said, there hasn't been anything going on at all. And he's going, why is that? Why isn't there something? He was not upset, but he was pushing to get something started. So he definitely agreed to do that. And that just gave me an impetus to keep working at this. And I had a lawyer. And so it was at that point that Trish had called. And yes, it was just total serendipity at the CTOS meeting. There we are, sitting in the back. And at the break, we turned and introduced each other. And there it was. So yes, I had the documents. That's one thing I'm good at. I'm good at a lot of the paperwork and typing and so forth, but really had no idea where to go after that. The Thorntons, I sent them by email the bylaws and whatever other things I had. And they took the ball and ran with it. They are the true founders, because it sure wouldn't have happened with just me. I didn't know what to do, but they did. And I think maybe it's a connection to DC and FDA and so forth that they have in their background that they got the ball rolling. Really, fundamentally, I just wanted to say there was just very little research, and I couldn't believe it. Year after year, it's like the same old thing. There was a lot being done in the diagnostic field. We had a lot of immunohistochemical markers come online in the 80s, which identified more sarcoma entities, more sarcoma subtypes. Amongst rhabdo, for example, there were myosarcoma, there were only two subtypes. Now there's six or seven, and they're all run by different genes. So actually, what has happened due to the Sarcoma Foundation is a lot of research. It encourages not only the research that we fund, but also it gets the whole sarcoma community working in their other institutions to do similar things. So the genes have now, there's been a molecular explosion, actually, amongst what genes run each and every sarcoma type and subtype. Some of these subtypes are as different as night and day. Amongst rhabdomyosarcoma, alveolar rhabdo, and embryonal rhabdo are as different as breast cancer is to lung cancer. So we have to start, and I think obviously the oncologists know now, that you've got to treat each sarcoma differently. Each, not only the type, but the subtype is so different, and they're all very different, and there are nearly 100 different kinds. So anyway, it started with a desire for some research, and I think, boy, did we get the ball rolling, and we're in a great place today, and we're being global.
Mark, did you work at the FDA at the time that SFA was founded?
Yes, I was working there, and I brought that knowledge and insight into the activities of the SFA, in the sense that, and like I said before, we appreciated the success of the AIDS activists and the other cancer advocates with reaching out to FDA as an impediment as opposed to a partner in trying to develop the cancer drugs, at least when it came to speed and the focus and energy. So being there as a general medical officer, in a division of clinical trial design and analysis, reviewing a lot of internal medicine type drugs. It's my background and training. The notion of sarcoma was present, or there was a lack of a presence of that within FDA. We developed a regulatory strategy to parlay on top of other groups' efforts and model a lot of things and have a few nuances of our own. For example, there was an early effort. There's a process with FDA, I think with the government in general, called a citizen's petition. And it's an effort to address a specific regulatory policy within the government, in this case, the FDA approval process. And so we noticed that most cancer drugs were based on massive phase 3 trials, and that it was just very much inconsistent with a rare type cancer like sarcoma, let alone the subtypes of sarcoma and other rare cancers. So we had worked with a couple of different organizations that were also advocating for quicker processes to get approvals, and crafted this citizen petition, which was a cool thing to reach out and try to directly influence policy. And so we sent that in, and it was our first kind of experience with the headwinds that I guess we all know about when it comes to getting the government to change. And so that kind of morphed me into less of a more of a gadfly, like someone that became a fair critic, which is to say my sort of efforts began to get more in line with the other cancer groups that were getting quite worked up about the lack of progress as the months rolled into the early 2000s. And just by good luck with all the different people that you encounter, there was a fellow that was one of the editors or on the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, and he was a cancer patient advocate. And I guess we bonded a bit. And before I know it, we're talking about writing op-eds into the Wall Street Journal, which has about a 2 million person subscriber list out there. And it was cool. Between 2005 and 2010, I penned about 5 or 6 different op-eds. And it was something that got pretty darn critical of FDA. And it was weird to be in FDA writing these things, that the people were supportive of this. And I actually rotated out of FDA and joined industry to try to develop cancer drugs in industry and continued to write those op-eds. And I think there is nothing like getting the spotlight on an agency, in this case, FDA. They notice, I think, especially when they see that an insider who knows where what the reality is and what can be done kind of points things out to them. I don't think they were too enamored with me, but I didn't care because it was, I think we were all just really pushing. And I don't know if it had a real impact, but there was quite a sea change over the years. And I can say very proudly with regards to being proud of FDA, they are now very much not an adversary at all. They're very, and Brandon can tell you too, that they've become a partner with us in not just sarcoma, but cancer as a whole. And so when it comes to we advocated for, it took a bit of doing. And of course, the academic community, Dr. George Dimitri specifically was one voice there that helped create a streamlined pathway for sarcoma drugs that are for patients that have gone through the first round of standard of care drugs and where the approvals are based on overall survival. And then it used to be that for drugs that for people that fail or are refractory to those drugs, the sort of second tier drugs, those also used to have an expectation for overall survival for approval. And through a lot of hemming and hawing and different public meetings and George's help, and Jack was also quite with us because he's quite the policy guy as well. Now, progression-free survival is the regulatory endpoint, which might not seem like much, but it shrinks the timelines for approvals by a couple of years, if not more. And that's where every day counts. And then more importantly, when you provide industry with a quicker pathway, it makes it a little more interesting to them to consider sarcoma. And that was the other sort of triangulating one thing against the other, was to work with industry quite a bit to let them know that we were doing these things. I used to joke that we're trying to make sarcoma sexy to them so that they would say, hey, it might actually be worth studying a rare cancer and investing in it because the advocates have come up with a quicker pathway. You never know what kind of impact you have with all this stuff, but lo and behold, now there's quicker pathways and some of it is within sarcoma, and FDA is very responsive these days to any kind of outreach like that. And Randy's been in the thick of it with working with FDA and trying to foster all these things that we began years ago.
I'd like to just get back to the beginning of the foundation because I want to put another feather in Trish and Mark's cap. I guess they were very enamored of that first $25 that they got as a donation, but whatever their incipient website that they started up, they somehow got a connection to the New York folks, a number of whom had children with sarcoma.
What did you think? Okay, here's the things that we know we need to accomplish to be able to move the needle in sarcoma. And how does that compare to SFA today?
Yeah, I would say because we were focused on, you do these kinds of things, and I should say that when it comes to founders, we would credit Jeffrey Thornton, our son, with founding the organization because we never really would have had the energy or the passion without thinking that what we were doing might help save our child, because Tricia said this was a fatal diagnosis. And so our thought was to try to do everything possible. Matter of fact, our early slogan was finding the cure in our time. Mm-hmm. So thus the notion of speed and a laser focus on the cure. In other words, we noticed that when it came to modeling our group with others, that yes, breast cancer group were doing education of patients and they were reaching out for this or that purpose to try to address the multiple needs of the cancer patients. But our group, we wanted to have a singular sole laser focus on the cure. And it probably was not a coincidence that both Jack and I, being physicians, were focused on medical type things, as maybe if we were lawyers, maybe there would have been some other type of thought process behind things. But when it came to all of our efforts, it was, and we appreciated, I think both Jack and I and Tricia, that really people have different opinions about the drug industry. But there is no other machine like the drug industry that is the one and only generator of these cures. And for all the capitalism reasons, that's where all the energy and money and focus is behind all the fortunes it takes to develop cancer drugs. So we very much knew that was a very important piece of it. So that's this partnering with the pharmas, trying to goose along FDA to speed the approvals, as well as raising money to get research. There's different types of research that cancer groups like the NIH fund. People have probably heard of basic research versus translational research. It's nice to do basic research, but it's one of these little nuggets of information that may in 50 years mean something to be derogatory. But we wanted something that was translational, that if we're going to put $100,000 into a grant, we want the results of that to foster the cure. We didn't care about knowledge so much as progress per se. And so that was, so it all, as you could probably get a picture of it, we were driven that way. Now, to Brandy's question about now. So over the years, though, a lot of people come into the organization, the board of directors, with thanks to Brandy's efforts and just the success over the years. Once you grow into a multi-million dollar type organization, you find that you do have some of the capacity to expand, to look at in other directions, and to respond to the community, because you do hear about the patients that are suffering with regards to, say, the morbidity of surgery or the different approaches with other things like handling second opinions and different types of other needs that the patients have. I've always stressed that we didn't want to have a mission creep and do too much. The bandwidth couldn't get too big, but certainly it evolved into where there was, without feeling a loss of the general focus on cures, there was, with listening to other people and basically being able to be more of a other kind of services, in other words. And Brandy's the person that's been leading all the other nuances besides just the notion of new drugs. That's a piece of the differences between then and now.
Yeah, I would add that I think two things really helped get us off the ground in those early days. And Mark said the focus was on translational research. It wouldn't be me deciding who gets a grant. We formed the medical advisory board, and who did we pick? Famous people around the country in that field. These people were famous already. And so they would be a board deciding in the same way as an NIH grant is decided. And so it was very fair. There were scores given and so forth, and we allocated the money accordingly in a very proper and nationally acclaimed way. The second thing I would say that helped the organization and the galas in particular is that we decided, you know what, there are no awards in this field. And we started creating a couple of them in the beginning, and both for the patients as well as for the healthcare providers. And I think that really gave us a boost in everyone's mind around the country, because you know what? A lot of these prominent physicians that they are, nonetheless, they don't get an award or they don't get a pat on the back. And if our organization was going to have such an award, it's another feather in their cap. So I think that attracted people to us and made us more visible around the country. And I think helped raise more money, basically, for the foundation.
I have a question about the research. Seeing as SFA was born out of the need of more research for sarcoma, how do you feel the quality of research has changed or shifted in the last 25 years, or has it, from your perspective?
I would like to speak to that a bit. The amount of research going on now in sarcoma is, I don't know, triple, quadruple, maybe 10 times what it was in, say, 2001. And secondly, it's of a quality that's really unmatched by any other tumor type research. Next gen sequencing going on now for sarcoma on a small little biopsy is incredible. They not only test for the genes that are known to affect different types of cancers, including sarcoma, but they will sequence the whole gene of your own tumor. So that is something that is just leaps and bounds different from the past two decades. The diagnostic realm is also incredibly better. There are now 50 to 60 immunohistochemical markers that pathologists use to be sure exactly what type and subtype a patient has, because that's going to get them on the proper treatment trajectory. So diagnostically, it's better. in the lab, the analysis of these tumors is way better. And I would say also clinically, and Mark can speak better to this, the clinical trials are better and quicker, as he's already mentioned. So it's night and day in the last 20 years.
I know Tricia was very involved in making the FACE research program happen. So it was one thing to decide, okay, we want to fund research because we need more research and we need to fund translational research. But then you had to pull all of that together. How did you come up with a system to be able to collect the proposals?
I was fortunate enough at the time myself, I was working for a research organization. We did a lot of that. And so I based it, my idea anyway, to base it on how, what we were doing there. And I came up with how we would go and make a request for proposals. And I did it with ours. And then there was Uniformed Services, University of the Health Sciences that was on the campus as well. And I combined the two. And I ran that past Jack to see if this would work and how would we do it and just get the basics down and if it would look good. And then I think in the early days, when we were putting it out there, we put it out at different meetings, ASCO, CTOS, just so people would know we were doing this. We've had a chicken and egg thing, though, if I'm trying to remember correctly, because we didn't have a lot of money at the time. And we met some other people, as Jack mentioned, and we got a commitment for $75,000, grants for $25,000 each at the time. And this one man, he was in New York, and he had some connections with some people. And he got commitments. And so we were trying to get that because we knew we were putting out the request that we were going to fund these grants at the same time we were trying to secure the funding. And thankfully, we were very lucky. It all worked out. We were actually able to announce it at our first gala, come to think of it, that we were able to fund three grants.
Yeah. And we were basically kind of living on a shoestring in the sense that dime we got, it didn't go for any, we didn't really have any overhead because we were operating out of our home. And so this $75,000, Al Sunshine was the fellow's name in New York at the time. We were, like Tricia said, we were able, I think we had raised about $25,000 more. And so that first year we were able to get the word out. And by that, it took a lot of phone calls. Email wasn't a main way there. I remember going to several meetings a year where the docs would be there and I'd have flyers to hand out and to try to gain interest to say that there was going to be this group giving money out. And Jack was instrumental in creating this sort of judging board using the NIH process that he's very familiar with. And so we got together, like Jack said, a group of six or eight of the doctors. And with this request for a proposal that Tricia mentioned, it got out there and we must have got maybe 10 or 12 or 15 applications through our rudimentary process that's been very much refined since then. And so, yeah, I believe it might have been our first gala, and we were able to announce the first recipients. And then there were influential people from different parts of New York there. Then suddenly, it was by the next year, we had six figures or more, and it all just steamrolled there. And it would be remiss to not mention the name of the Tomei family, Gary and Eddie Tomei. They're the parents of the people know the Academy Award-winning actress Marissa Tomei. They were New Yorkers, very influential. They basically drove a lot of the money that came in. And the gala at the time was also a fundraiser to fuel a lot of things. It's been a rise from those three or four in the first couple of years. And that's been another mechanism of trying to be smart with spending to have it be efficient and an investment into something that could lead to things. And this is where the power and strength of our investigators and the community. They're the brains behind having the science and the wherewithal to apply to the government to take what the research might have been funded by our small grants, but be able to say, okay, NIH, here's the data that you wanted to show proof of principle or something. Now we want to do a multi-million dollar grant. And then that's been a big return on investment, so to speak, that's been successful in several cases. And I also would be remiss to not credit the investigators. Turns out that all these centers have little pools of money of their own, and they have their own internal funding to match or sometimes add to the research that we might give them funding for. As everyone knows, very much committed, dedicated, passionate about doing everything they can, wherever they can, but to try to raise support and funding to allow more research.
But you're right, it has grown. I think that first year we got seven applications. And then the next year was 14, and we made the joke each year it seemed to be multiples of 7, 14, 21, and so on. Go ahead, John.
I'd like to add to what Mark said. we're not only funding the research and getting results, but we're helping to create the next generation of sarcoma researchers. So often these are younger guys at one of the famous institutions who, if they got the grant, they were going to tackle some aspect of a sarcoma. If they didn't, they wouldn't be in the sarcoma field. Some time ago, I did a study or sent out a survey, and indeed, the results came back that quite a number of people who got grants went into the sarcoma field. So the grants themselves are helpful, of course, to try to find new knowledge and translational research for patient care, but it's also rebirthing, if you will, the next generation of people interested in helping out this field.
So in terms of the New York Gala, it's interesting we're coming full circle because in 2023, we honored the three of you with our Sarcoma Legacy Award. And Natasha was the one that presented the award to you, but Natasha didn't work at SFA at the time. Natasha is a survivor of sarcoma. And I remember, Natasha, what you said, if it weren't for you, I might not be here today. And now Natasha is on SFA's team.
This is incredibly full circle to have given you that award and then be sitting here today talking about the progress that's been made. It's emotional. Like Brandy said, I distinctly remember reading the story of SFA's founding and being like, that research is why I could be sitting here.
We know how important the gala is to our research funding, as well as now our Race to Cure Sarcoma events. But for the history of SFA, I think it's important to talk about the gala. And you've mentioned a little bit about how it started and the role it played in all of those years.
I think it was very early in our founding, around, I think, 2002, we got an email from Gary Tomei. And his son had been diagnosed with the sarcoma and he wanted to help. So he and his wife, Addie, joined up with us and their members, and they decided they would like, and they're very interested in the research grants themselves, and they wanted to fund a grant. And so they thought they would like to have a little fundraiser in New York where they lived with, I think at the time it would just be a cocktail party type thing with family and friends, but they really didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to put an event together. Their daughter had a friend named Lisa Johnson, who was an event planner, and they thought they would just ask her for help. And of course, Lisa came in and said, no, you know, it's a small thing. We can go big and we can do this thing. And she really put this great event together. Honestly, it's still my favorite gala, I think, after all these years. And we were at Laura Bell Supper Club in New York. It's not there any longer, but it was certainly more than family and friends that showed up. We honored that year U.S. Senator Mark Pryor. He was there at it. It was just really was amazing. So again, this was about 2002. So the first gala was June 22nd, 2003. We had our very first gala at Laura Bell Supper Club, and we made over $185,000. And we were thrilled. I told Gary and Addie, I said, well, that'll definitely fund a couple of grants. As I said, at the time, they were only $25,000. But that's really how it began. And then they thought they would be done. And they're like, oh, we did it. And they weren't, that was all going to do. But then Lisa Johnson talked, no, you got to do it again. You got to be the chairman again next year. And so they were. And it was even more successful the next year. And then they stayed with us. And then Gary was on the board for several years after that. And so they were with us for quite some time.
I think our largest gala topped $1 million a couple of different years.
That was much later in our, later so down the line, we made $1 million.
But it was always very much touch and go. We never quite knew, who knows what could happen on any given day with regards to New York, and would we have a successful year or unsuccessful year? So it was nerve-wracking every year. And about 15 years ago or so, the thought was to try to de-risk the gala, so to speak, have some other means to raise funds. And so Brandy's insight was to really turbocharge this whole race for the cure. And that has more than offset the gala. But it was remarkable. After every gala, it would be one hit after another. And the Tomeis were a huge part of it. The Tomeis moved on several years ago. Another New York family stepped up. And then Brandy came on and has been leading the efforts along that way, as well as everything else that she does. And it's just continued to be a success story. Again, trying to unite the aspects of New York that people think of. You've got the artists in the village down there providing entertainment, the Wall Street people with their not just investing money, but also focus on drugs. And we attract the drug companies to come and give them awards. and that helps. And then, of course, you've got the Upper East Side types that are the Sloan Kettering gang that the different doctors will make the word out, give the word out to their patients. So you end up with this room full of people that are just a powerful bunch that, when it comes to generosity, the passions of the night, everyone opens their wallets, and these are spectacular potentials. But now it's a good, solid type of an event.
That is how the New York Gala became reality. And as you know, New York is filled with all the financial people, and they found that some of these folks from J.P. Morgan and other financial institutions had sarcomas, and people would buy whole tables and fund grants to $10,000, $20,000. So that all started because the Thorntons got the word out through the website and I guess some phone calls and what have you. But that was really the kickoff. Besides starting the organization, the New York Gala was really the start of true fundraising for the foundation.
I think it's important for us to talk about the role the New York Gala played in SFA's ability to fund research and how important it was to where we are today, actually. And also the fact that here we are in September having another New York Gala, our 23rd annual New York Gala.
I know one thing we've discussed over the years is what with so many different types of sarcomas, we would hear, and Brandy, this is even well before you came along, that somebody out in Ohio would start a little organization because their son or daughter or family member got a sarcoma, and they would have a little race or maybe just a dinner, a get together, a fundraiser. Their money, that they wouldn't know what to do with it. And gradually, which has been amazing, we have become the umbrella for all of these sarcoma types and all these different families and get-togethers. And so we become the vehicle to disperse their money for a grant named in their honor. So that has been a gradual thing, but now there's no doubt we are the Sarcoma Foundation of America. And not only that, as Brandy may well chime in here, we have things going on nationally and internationally. Certainly our grants started that. We started giving grants in Europe and France and Italy and Germany and so forth. And now we are practically running programs in a global fashion. So it is amazing to me how far this organization has come in the 25 years. It's something that I'm most proud of in my life to be part of it. And as I said, I was a smaller part of it, but I am so tickled at how far it's become.
Yeah, it is amazing. We've hired our first person in the UK that's helping us, and we do fund research globally. But even this podcast, we have listeners on five continents. We have gotten requests for assistance from people from other countries. Our national virtual Race to Cure Sarcoma has turned into the global virtual Race to Cure Sarcoma because we had people from all around the world participating in our race in July. Even our Sarcoma Awareness Month childhood children's art, we had people from other countries submit their artwork. So we have truly expanded our reach globally. And that is, again, to think about something that started from your house to where we are today. When you look back at all of the things that SFA has accomplished, what are some of the things that you're most proud of? It doesn't have to be the biggest things, but from your standpoint, what are the things that you're most proud of? Because I have to be honest, Mark, I had no idea that you actually handed out flyers to get people interested in our program. So the fact that you were at meetings handing out flyers is actually humbling, quite frankly, as a leader of this organization to think that's how we started.
For me, it would be the formation of the Medical Advisory Board, because I think that put the stamp of acceptability and, what would I say, the proper methodology for scoring sarcomas that was accepted throughout the country. So in that case, then anybody at any institution in America knew that this wasn't some fly-by-night group that was going to do it on favoritism but rather it was going to do it the same as the National Institutes of Health. So for me, that was my idea to get all those folks on board. And I think that has cemented our research grant application process to be in the proper realm. So I'm very happy with that. Very proud.
And they still play such a significant role, not only in our research funding, but in the direction of our organization as well.
I would say that, you know, to echo Jack there, but also just from the point of view of expediting drugs more quickly, the success in getting that streamlined pathway that FDA now uses for second line sarcoma approvals was a big one. I think more on an emotional level, when we were wondering what might be available for Jeffrey if his sarcoma returned, there was nothing. And so the notion of having any options were not there. And to think that now, 25 years later, for in his case, alveolar soft part sarcoma, there must be a good 8 or 10 arrows in the quiver, so to speak, against that disease. And so when it comes to hope and potential for a prolonging life of patients, not just with ASPS, but you just go down the line with the your sarcoma subtype. And I would say that opposed to where there was virtually nothing, if once you got ifosfamide and doxorubicin back in the day, that was it. You might get higher doses. You might get a different kind of combination of it. But good luck. Right. That was it. Maybe more surgery. Now it is targeted therapy, immunotherapy, combination therapy, gene therapy, cell therapy. The first solid tumor cell therapy was in a sarcoma subtype within the last couple of years. It's just wonderful. The idea was to, like everything in cancer, is to not necessarily cure the disease, but prolong life, extend life, so that people lived old age, just like we've seen with different diseases, the one that with cancer writ large and with sarcoma specifically. So I think in the case of giving that, now how much credit to take, a minuscule amount, I'm sure, in the scheme of things. But I think tilting the needle, so to speak, making it move a little more, I think in some way, it feels like we've done that.
And did one more thing. I remember at one of the meetings very early on, we were thinking about the gala and so forth. And I believe that I suggested the whole idea of giving it an award. Now, of course, it's blossomed into many awards and the Courage Award, this award and so forth. But I think that did help get us going as well.
I would just say I'm proud that we were actually able to do it and get it off the ground. And it's just amazing that we were able to put this organization together and hopefully give hope to so many people. That was very much involved in those days. I was everything, the secretary, the accountant, the whole thing.
You are.
The office manager. So I had a lot in those days of just really talking with people. And that was nice for me and proud to be able to hopefully give comfort to people when they'd call, because people were so upset and just looking for hope and looking for just something. And I was able to talk with those people, just hearing their stories and hopefully helping them some and giving some comfort. I heard a lot of the stories. And I got a lot of the pictures that people would send pictures and articles. And so I miss that in a way now, that being so close to it, because I'm not as close to it as I was then. But just the fact, looking back all these years later and say, hey, we had a hand in that. We had a hand in helping people. So that feels really good. And I'm proud of that.
I would say each of the three of us have our own skills, and certainly Mark does. But Trish is a unusual type of person. In the early days, there's no doubt, it kept going because of Trish. She took in the money. She knew how to collect it and organize it. She was in the early days hiring people and so forth, and she would be keeping everybody happy. There's a certain person who needs to be there as a glue to the early organization. And that was Trish. That is her strength, and kudos to her. She did an amazing job.
Still does.
I think what my strength was, you guys were the brains behind it. I was the facilitator. I just kept things going and making, you know, just running the grants program. I would say that. And I just facilitated everything. I depended you all on the science and the brains.
ideas with no action goes nowhere.
It makes things happen. And the organization wouldn't exist without that. We talk about that even now with the board, how important the infrastructure is to be able to do all the things that SFA does. And so that's an important piece. Wasn't SFA instrumental in bringing together and talk about what was needed to move sarcoma forward?
Mark got that going, I think. Right, Mark?
Yes. The Progress Review Group was a program that the National Cancer Institute had. And the pancreatic cancer group, the breast cancer group, began to engage the government. We found out about it in our efforts to try to see what others were doing and adopt the best practices. So it was a mechanism that NCI announced in the late 90s to get together in a big group, people from academia, from government, from FDA, from industry, and all try to get the collaborative consensus on how to really foster progress in the specific disease or specific cancer type that the PRG, as it was called, was focused on. So that was quite the logistical event to put together. NCI did a lot of the work, as this is their strong point, in getting together the groups and funding this 3 or 4 day process. The big 90 plus page white paper that came out really talked about the blueprint for how the entire community could move forward. And so that was quite the focus of everybody during the 2000s. It was very much government focused, as you might imagine, meaning that everything evolved from the core of it being that the money was coming from the government, which is, I think Jack alluded to, is can be waxing and waning in the case of sarcoma. And sure enough, it did wane a bit in the mid-2000s, had boost during the Obama years of where they doubled, I think, or at least they had the surge of funding for NIH, and that trickled down to the sarcoma space a bit. And that's where the gaps and the sort of ebbs and flows, when there were ebbs in this emphasis from the government, that made it all the more important that SFA was there with other groups, any group. We've always welcomed anyone. There should be no competition with, we're all in this together. But any advocates trying to raise money, trying to either add to or fill in the needs that NCI was not funding. For example, the NCI funds different governmental trials, but the money that they give the sarcoma groups only covers certain costs. And to inspire investigators to participate, we developed the knack over the years to appreciate that if we could grease the skids of some of these clinical trials by offering translational research that were part of the bigger structural money that was coming for a big clinical trial, these little 50, 75K, 100K contributions, that helped foster things. But long story short, that PRG was quite galvanizing. And I think it's be fun to look back at that and see where we are today versus that document. I'll bet you a lot of the goals of the time, which have all materialized. I remember, especially like molecularly driven therapies, like Jack was alluding to, were just gleams in people's eyes back in 2004. 20 years later, like Jack was saying, there's all these molecular targeted drugs for all the different sarcoma subtypes and more on the way.
I think that was in Philadelphia, wasn't it, Mark? And Lee Hellman and the major NIH people were there.
Yeah.
All sarcoma treatment people were there. And as you said, they came out with this paper. It was a little disappointing as the years went on afterwards that the NIH did not act on what they themselves wrote out as a plan of action. To me, it was disappointing that they didn't. For example, I think they suggested that there should be a national tumor registry for sarcoma. And of course, that never happened. Yes, to answer Brandy's question, that was an excellent thing to be done. And we got, Kirk and his team there got it done.
Yeah. Was that phase involvement? Did we help lead it?
Yeah, we sent a lot of strongly worded letters, as they say, to the different NCI type funders to get us on the list. We didn't want to be left behind. You really have to make your voice heard. That's basically my approach, has been to rarely think of things originally, know how to know a good thing when I see it, and try to model our practices on that. When it comes to saying the pancreatic cancer group just had one, why can't we? And of course, some of the doctors, Larry Baker at the time, Bob Benjamin, different names that are maybe not around much anymore. They're retired or semi-retired. But there were a lot of there always have been strong voices that are there yelling with us to get attention for this. I would say that SFA was a pretty, was at least a piece of that energy that Larry Baker, I remember, he was quite prominent and influential. And Lee Hellman, credit him too. And he was at NIH, and it's a small band of brothers and sisters that come together and push the levers of this big machine that's out there. And once in a while, they send a few bucks our way. And in this case, we all made that happen and had that, because I think the PRG route for other cancers began to dry up, like Jack said. And so we got in on the tail end and had, if not a lot of money coming from that with subsequent years, certainly the blueprint in and of itself was quite powerful as a guide that we all signed on to some big treaty or something. And it really was quite the guiding document for several years.
Jack, you mentioned that we based our research off of the NIH model, and Tricia set up the request for proposals process, and we had the MAB then review them, which is exactly what we still do today for our sarcoma research grant program. But why is our research funding different?
So first of all, each and every institution that has a sarcoma center, for example, does have people that want to dabble in research. And just because they have an idea that they think is good doesn't mean that it's worth a lot of money or worth the time and effort. First of all, that was already known, that there were people around the country doing research at their own institution, but not a lot, and not a lot with any kind of rigorous overlook in terms of evaluating the scientific rigor of what they were proposing. So what we have done is provided an organization that will take in various grants of all kinds. And we get 60 to 80 plus applications every year now. And all of those are ranked by our medical advisory board. They then give it a score, and then it gets a grant average. And the ones with the one or two, that's the top. But we go through a whole process. But I think people around the country realize, hey, this isn't just local yokel stuff. These are the top ideas identified by the top people in the country. So we have the process. Yes, they can go to NIH. But where we fit the bill is in the pre-NIH grant process. People have a very good idea, but for NIH grants, you almost have to have a lot of results before you get their money to fund their research. So it's our seed money, if you will, whether it was $25,000 in the beginning or $50,000 and now even $75,000 per grant, will provide that researcher the time and effort to get his and her sarcoma results to then go on to get an NIH-funded grant. But so that's the space we occupy. But I think the difference is we brought a sort of a national standard to it all, and a place where people can be assured that the money that they raise for their loved ones is used for the best possible purpose.
What is your hopes and dreams for SFA in the next 25 years? We've done a lot of reflecting on the past, but as someone here doing the work now, I want to know, what do you hope for SFA moving forward in the next 25 years?
To me, simply find the cure. That's for it. I hope we can do it.
Yeah, I think what I would be ideal is, this might sound strange, but to not have an SFA might not have a need for SFA, because there would be, the cure would have been found. And so that would be the ultimate full circle to start this process and to make advancements so much so that let's move on to the next problem. But of course, cancer being cancer, the likelihood is just continued evolution and more years, longer lives. You notice that the AIDS activists are not going anywhere, but despite probably what is now not much of a death sentence anymore for AIDS, people are living out full lives. It's getting that way with cystic fibrosis, but they're still around. There's always people that failed drugs. There's always a need for the next generation. But yeah, I think just people that follow the science.
We say that a lot, that we'd like survival,
a survival curve for sarcoma. And you want that, if it was at 20%, 25 years ago, you want that, and it might be 50% now or 60%. You want that to be 90%, 95% in 20 years. That would be great.
Yeah, I would just echo that. Just better survival data, better and more different types of treatment for all the different types of sarcomas, more researchers involved in the whole activity. And I think as the way it's going with our organization and under Brandy, a more global approach will help. These aren't the most common. It's only 1% of all cancers. And while the United States and our researchers can do a lot and our clinicians, it'll help if we have the rest of the world kicking in. So that would be a tremendous development in the future.
What do you think is our greatest challenge? Looking back, they've made so much progress. What do you think still remains challenges for us?
That's different. I was just thinking keeping people engaged, because sometimes when it's a chronic disease, say just cystic fibrosis, it's a lifelong thing, so people will stay and work with it. In sarcoma, what we found is if someone has it, a lot of times if they pass away, the family doesn't want to be involved anymore or at all. So that's just the end of their road. If someone's cured from it, a lot of times they're like, I want to put this in my past and not think about it anymore. So it's not something so it's hard to get a community together sometimes just because people won't stay engaged for whatever reason for any period of time. So it's hard to get that kind of following, if you will, for lack of a better word.
I couldn't agree more. That is, if you lose a loved one, that happens, is that there's that passion to do something in the person's name. Life moves on, and it's not as much that way. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That trying to keep people engaged and come up with methods to try to do that. But otherwise, by the outreach, by making it very much visible so people know via the website or other means that there is a place to go to devote that energy. And try to, like Brandy tries to make, have the people remain and continue and be a part of a family that comes back. That's quite a challenge. But if that could be, that would be a big boost to what's otherwise a pretty successful model. But yeah, some of the more successful organizations manage, and maybe sometimes it's a, like Tricia said, it's a function of the type of disease we're talking about, Alzheimer's, et cetera. People stay engaged for very long lengths of time for that reason. And so that's one challenge for sure.
Yeah, when I talk to some of these sarcoma patients and their families, amongst some of them, there's a certain level of frustration that, darn it, something isn't happening now that can help my family member or someone I know. And so to me, that's always been, I have to feel apologetic because things aren't going. But an awful lot has been done. And as we're chipping away at the genes, I have to believe that the right markers and maybe magic bullets will get discovered. I can see why long-term, why some people might fall out of the community, but we just have to keep getting the word out there. And of course, there are more and more people each year getting sarcomas. We can just have to keep up the flow of involved individuals.
I think that's why conversations like this are so important too, because I know from the patient perspective, I lose a friend like every few months to sarcoma, and it does sometimes feel like it's not moving fast enough. There's people dying, and I completely empathize with that. But at the same time, you do have to think about how much has been done in these 25 years and how much more there is to do, but you need that drive to keep doing that. And that's why these conversations are so important, to keep that energy going, appreciate what we've done, and understand what we still need to do with the new challenges that we have. It's a good thing to have new challenges because that means we're making progress.
Usually Natasha asks the last question, but I do want to ask anything that we did not touch on from your all's perspective that you guys think is important for us to mention.
Yeah, I would like to say that one thing that worries me, and I know the Thorntons have thought about this over the years, is what happens when we step aside. Believe me, even though I'm a background person and a pathologist and the patients never see me, although I have seen many patients in my office, and they can describe in their terms what their tumor means. But aside from all that, even though I'm in the background, I'm very passionate about this. When we have the patient under the microscope and I'm looking at their slides, for that moment, they're my patient. And I know how old they are and where the tumor was from and how long they had it there and the whole nine yards. So, but what I worry about is, okay, who around the country would replace me? I'm getting older, and I sure would like to stay with the organization until my dying days, but I do worry about the transition. Not so much on the CEO side, Brandy.
That's my concern.
There's a million things that SFA could be doing, but what makes sense for SFA is always the question. And so for me, I think the three of you really provide that sort of North Star of, yeah, we are expanding, but we're still expanding in a way that fits to the essence of what SFA was meant to do and where we are meant to have an impact. The good thing of growth and the good thing of where SFA is now, we get so many requests to do different things. And it is really being that laser focused on the things that will actually fit within our strategic goals and how do we expand our impact in a way that fits with the essence of and what we're trying to accomplish. SFA was established by three people, as you said, who really came together and knew what to do. And then had, and as you said, Jack, I really think you all had different skill sets and you all had different focus, and bringing all of those together to be able to have that expertise and that drive to be able to make it happen. So yeah, there was a little luck, but you actually had to know what to do as well to show that you are making progress and you are worthy of an investment. That's a very different thing than just having a story. You have to make progress, which you did. And we're not done yet. We're just talking about 25 years. We got a long way to go.
I'm curious what your advice is for sarcoma patients, but I'm also curious what your advice is for researchers.
I think we should leave that to Jack, since he was always giving me advice that started this. So the full circle moment will be Jack giving advice.
Yeah, I do talk to a lot of people who have different types of cancer. And the first thing I tell them is don't believe everything you read on the internet, because a lot of people with sarcoma, even though they know their diagnosis, they don't know all the other details about it or whether it has a specific subtype that may be better or one that may be worse. So I tell them that. I also try to explain when they tell me or send me actually their path report that then I can tell them more specifics and tell them where they stand and what to expect. But in terms of other things, I like to instill hope that there's possibility for different types of treatment and what have you. So the advice that I would give the average sarcoma patient is just assemble your information, make sure you have the right stuff, and don't believe everything online where it sounds like a death sentence. And as for the researchers, it's just keep plugging away. You got to have a good idea. You have to be smart enough to realize what's already been done so you're not repeating the past. And you need a certain skill set. So it takes people years to get to the point where they have the tools. I would just keep encouraging them to keep plugging away.
Great advice. Thank you all so much for being here. This is really so special, and we're so grateful for your time. So thank you for joining us for this episode.
Thank you.
SFA created Sarcoma Stories to highlight the individual stories of sarcoma patients, survivors, and care partners. To amplify the many stories we consistently hear and bring together the broad range of lived experiences of sarcoma patients, SFA has also created a Sarcoma Journey Survey. This survey is vitally important as we need to collect data for sarcoma subtypes to help advance research and effective treatments and put data to the stories we consistently hear. To learn more about this survey and to take the survey yourself, please head to the show notes and you'll find the survey link. Thanks for joining us today. Did this episode resonate with you? You can join the discussion about this episode in our Sarcoma Stories Facebook group, linked in the show notes. If you found this podcast helpful, your feedback is incredibly valuable and helps to create more awareness about sarcoma while sharing vital resources with someone who may need it. Be sure to leave a rating and review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.